Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Deborah Becker. In for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. There's been a cautious response today from Iran's leadership to an unprecedented video message that President Barack Obama sent to the country. The video was made to commemorate the start of the Iranian New Year, Nowruz. Obama's not the first U.S. president to speak to Iranians on this holiday, but his use of video and his language are different.
The United States wants the Islamic Republic of Iran to take its rightful place in the community of nations. You have that right, but it comes with real responsibilities. And that place cannot be reached through terror or arms, but rather through peaceful actions that demonstrate the true greatness of the Iranian people and civilization.
Also in a surprise move, Israel's president Shimon Peres sent a video message to Iran. And joining us from Beirut to talk about this is Borzu Deragahi. He's Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Hello, Borzu.
Hello, how are you?
Okay. Well, how significant is this video message from President Obama?
I think it's quite significant. I think it's kind of a watershed. I wouldn't call it a dramatic event-changing, game-changing action, but it definitely sets the stage for the possibility of a change in the 30-year tense relationship between Iran and the U.S.
And how would you describe the overarching message from it?
I think the message was respectful. It was the tone was very hopeful. It didn't include many of the threats or ultimatums or even subtly that have characterized, for example, Bush administration messages to Iran. So in that sense, it would be hard on the part of the Iranian leadership to point to big parts of this message as saying that you know that the U.S. is going to continue its same policy.
And what's been the response?
Well, so far the response from Iran has been optimistic, welcoming, but cautious. Iranians are saying that we want to see a change in policy, a change in action, and not just a change in diplomatic political tone.
Mm-hmm. And how do Iranians see this video?
Well, it's hard to gauge at this point because it's a major holiday right now in Iran. So you know, it's not like people are out on the streets waiting to be interviewed by the journalists who are there. But in general, it's very much true that Iranians like Obama. They like his face. They like his smile. They like the way he talks. As do most people in the Islamic world right now. So I'm sure it will be viewed very receptively by ordinary people.
Mm-hmm. And what about Iranian officials?
I think Iranian officials right now are concerned. They're worried about Obama, not quite sure what to make of him. In part, they're very worried in that they think that the U.S. is engaged in a complicated game of reaching out diplomatically, injecting diplomatic dialogue into their Iran strategy in an effort to reach out, but make sure that the policies don't change so that the diplomacy will fail. And then in that case, the U.S. will be in a better position to get China and Russia on board for tougher sanctions, tougher action against Iran. And this is not something that the Iranians grab out of the air. This is something that U.S. policymakers at think tanks in Washington have been proposing for some time. And so they're worried that this is all just a game meant to bring on harsher action.
And what about the video from Israeli President Shimon Peres?
Well, that was kind of a surprise. I'm curious to see how that will play out. I think one concern should be that the Iranian officials will lump together the Ahmadinejad speech with the Peres speech. I'm sorry, the Obama speech with the Peres speech, and essentially be in a position to be able to dismiss both of them, because although the Iranians are more than willing to have a normalized relations with the U.S., such relations with Israel are, for the time being, not really possible.
All right. Borzu Deragahi is Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with us from Beirut, Lebanon. Borzu, thanks very much.
It's been a pleasure.
The debate over whether a convicted murderer can be rehabilitated is raging in a small town in New Hampshire. In Chichester, population 2,400. Residents were told at town meeting last week that a man who spent 35 years in prison for murdering a child is now living in their community. Reverend David Pinckney, pastor at the River of Grace Church in Concord, New Hampshire, invited Raymond Guay to temporarily live in his home after a federal judge ordered that Guay serve 3 years of parole there after his release from prison. Reverend Pinckney says his wife and five children agreed to allow Guay to live with them because Guay's been transformed from the man who killed a 12-year-old boy in 1973. And he says Guay must follow strict rules while he lives in his home. But Reverend Pinckney's neighbors are not happy. Some children are no longer allowed to play outside, and newspaper reports indicate that someone hung a sign saying, "No kid killers," from a parked pickup truck in town. We'll hear from Reverend Pinckney in a moment, but first we turn to Merrimack County Sheriff Scott Hilliard, who helps the Chichester Police Department. Welcome, Sheriff.
Thank you.
Some residents of Chichester apparently have set up a neighborhood watch where they are monitoring Reverend Pinckney's home. There's a petition circulating asking for more police presence. What's happening to try to make residents feel more at ease because of this situation?
The chief has reached out to myself and to the state police to try to bring in additional sources. Obviously, it's a small department. Bring in additional resources to help him patrol the neighborhood and allay as much as we can the fears of the people. As you know, this is a very volatile situation, and to ask for 24-hour police presence to watch Mr. Pinckney's property is extremely expensive, and I'm not sure, at least I got the feeling from the meeting at Chichester the other night, that the selectmen do not feel that they can do that.
So when you say bring in more resources, are there extra officers from the area going to Chichester because of this?
Yes, there are.
Are you and state police adding extra officers because you're concerned about the reaction from the residents or because you're doing safety patrols because of Raymond Guay?
Actually, it's a combination of both. I think it's important that your listeners understand that no matter how we feel about Raymond Guay, we in law enforcement have an obligation to serve all of the citizens, and that includes Reverend Pinckney's safety and his family as well. Regardless of how we feel, the chief and I sat with Reverend Pinckney and Raymond Guay on Saturday and discussed concerns of theirs, their own safety, and things that they should and should not do.
So you met Mr. Guay?
I did.
You think he should leave?
I do. I say that first as a parent and second as a resident of a small town that I live in here in Merrimack County. And thirdly, as the sheriff of the county, because I think that his position would be better served in an environment where I understand he was in California, where he had closer supervision, where he had easier access to employment opportunities, and he was regularly monitored in that last setting in California, which obviously has a much larger population, and I'm sure probably has, you know, maybe multiple Raymond Guays living in their area. New Hampshire is immune to this, as you know. This is not just a child molester. This is a man that, by his own admissions, would tell you that, you know, his crime was horrendous. I'm not saying that he shouldn't be rehabilitated into society. I don't agree with the original sentence. I'll tell you that. I'm a law and order guy, and I was offended to see the sentence that he received for such a horrendous crime. But that's over and done with. There's nothing we can do about it. We need to do the best we can and provide safety for everybody.
Let's just briefly, when you mentioned California, let's just briefly tell our listeners he was initially in California to serve his parole and then was ordered to go to New Hampshire.
That's correct.
And apparently he has family in New Hampshire, but they have said that he cannot stay with them.
I understand that as well.
Mm-hmm. Legally, you cannot force Mr. Guay to leave New Hampshire, even though his victim, John Lindofsky Jr., was found shot in the woods in New Hampshire, and he was wearing only his underwear. Raymond Guay was never charged as a sex offender. He's not legally required to register. So as you say, he will be a completely free man in a very short time from now. So basically, there's nothing legally you or anyone else can do here.
That's correct.
Is there some NIMBYism here, not in my backyardism, happening here in Chichester, do you think, Sheriff?
I would say that is so. And I think if you follow Mr. Guay's two previous stops in New Hampshire, I think there were Derry and Manchester. In fact, our governor is on record to say that, you know, he doesn't feel he should be in New Hampshire. I think there is some NIMBYism, and I don't know that that's a bad thing. In 2.5 years, the man's going to be free. Do we believe in giving people a second chance? I think that we do in lots of things, but I think that we need to be realistic here. Most importantly, said best by Tom Tyler, the chief federal probation officer, Mr. Guay has been a man that has been institutionalized all of his life. And when you integrate people back into society, at least I think after 30 years of cop in our business, you do it a little bit at a time, and you do it in an environment where people who have serious personal crimes, crimes against other persons, that you make sure that the programs are in place, the safeguards are in place. Now, I will compliment Mr. Guay for agreeing to wear an ankle bracelet. I did review some of his federal probation guidelines, and that was not on there. Not that that is an end-all, be-all, but it is another tool that we in law enforcement can use in the event that Mr. Guay decides not to comply with the request and or leave the property on his own. Reverend Pinckney has assured us, me personally, and the chief, that Raymond was going to be monitored by an adult all the time.
He's not allowed to go into town unless he's in a vehicle and he doesn't have a license.
That's
I mean,
right.
There are some serious restrictions that Reverend Pinckney is putting on Raymond Guay. So I'm wondering if he's got people who support him and he's in a stable family environment and he's got these rules and he's willing to wear this electronic monitoring device, isn't that support enough? What more support could there really be for someone in his situation?
I honestly don't know that there could be any more support other than I think the position that he was in California was a halfway house program where he reported back. The only thing about halfway house programs like here in New Hampshire is when somebody doesn't report, you know, there's not a lot of time loss in between, and there's a proper response. And I'm not saying that there wouldn't be from David Pinckney if Raymond didn't show up for any particular time, but at least it's done by people that are this is their area of expertise.
Merrimack County Sheriff Scott Hilliard, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
When we return, why would a family with five children take in a man who admits to having killed a 12-year-old boy? We'll talk with the Reverend David Pinckney, who opened his home to Raymond Guay. Reverend Pinckney says Raymond Guay is transformed and is no threat to his family or the community. And later in the show, we'll speak with the author of a new novel for young adults about one girl's descent into depression and anorexia. This author has a warning for parents. We'll be back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. It's Here and Now. We return to the story of Raymond Guay, the man convicted 35 years ago of murdering a 12-year-old boy. He's been released from prison, and despite some vocal protests from residents, he's serving his parole in the small New Hampshire town of Chichester, living with Reverend David Pinckney, the pastor of the River of Grace Church in Concord, New Hampshire, who joins us now. Welcome, Reverend.
Sure thing.
What made you decide that this was the right time for you to invite Raymond Guay into your home?
Well, it's certainly not on one of the things I had on my list of things to do in 2009, for sure. It was actually his good friend, Al Lamori, who works with New Hampshire Prison Ministries. And Raymond was being sent back to New Hampshire to finish a supervised three-year parole status. So Al had contacted me to find out if we knew of anybody who would house Raymond. And so when he arrived in New Hampshire, I offered to have lunch with Al and Raymond. And sitting there and talking with Raymond and hearing his story, I felt this sort of like nudge, like, Dave, okay, why not me? Why look for somebody else? So took him home to my wife that night and said, let's, you know, what do you think? And she was good with it. We had him in for a turkey dinner on Thursday night, and Friday morning made a decision as a family that, yeah, we'll do this. So that's how the decision was sort of made.
Mm-hmm. Now you, your youngest child's 13.
Yep.
You're not nervous?
No, I'm not nervous, really, because there's been a 16-year track record of Raymond being an exemplary inmate. And the other thing is, you know, we are doing for Raymond what no one else would do, and that sort of act of love, I'm convinced, is probably the greatest safeguard we have. Believe me, I would not be doing this if I thought we were jeopardizing the security of our town, our neighbors, or our children. And if I had one instance of doubt or Raymond gave me a reason to question his credibility or his integrity, I'd make the phone call and he'd be out of here in an hour.
But it is still, even though you may have checked a lot of his references and talked with other folks, it's got to be difficult to put aside some of his past. He's been in and out of prison since he was 15 years old, been institutionalized for quite some time. He pleaded guilty to the 1973 murder of 12-year-old John Lindofsky. The boy was abducted in Nashua. He was later found shot, partially clothed in the woods. Guay broke out of prison twice. At one point, he held an elderly couple hostage. I mean, how do you know with this long history of violence that he's changed, and how do you look past all of this?
Well, I believe people change. I believe the man that is with us today is not the same man who was convicted of crimes 35 years ago. I've listened to many of his stories, and we've become pretty close. I mean, we spend some time together. We have coffee together in the morning. We sharing some scripture together. But if I was thinking I was dealing with the same man back in 1973, this conversation wouldn't be happening at all.
We spoke with a sheriff in New Hampshire who said that, you know, small town New Hampshire may just not be the place for Raymond Guay. We don't have public transportation. He doesn't have some of the support that he might have in a larger community. Maybe Chichester just isn't the place.
It isn't long term. And we made a 60-day commitment, and we will live by that. Long term, Raymond would rather be in Hartford, Connecticut, where there's public transportation. He has a job waiting for him there. He has an incredibly high work ethic. If you hear the hammering in the background, that's because he's offered to help finish our living room over our garage that we were constructing. And so I agree. small town is probably not the long-term place for Raymond.
We should just make sure that it's clear when you mention Hartford. Raymond was in California, and then he was ordered back to New Hampshire.
Yeah.
And because of the furor in New Hampshire, he left and went to Hartford, but then it was determined that he did, in fact, have to finish out this probationary period in New Hampshire. Is that what happened?
Yes, and the Hartford situation was, there was supposed to, and he wanted this, and it was part of the stipulation of his parole that he needed to do 6 months in a federal approved halfway house. Well, in New Hampshire, that we don't really have those. So there was this halfway house that focuses on getting parolees into the workforce in Hartford that took him in for 6 months. And he has talked to the director there, talked to a couple or one of the staff people there. You know, he was they miss him. He's a great guy. He could probably have an apartment right now because he had, like I said, he had a full time job in a restaurant furniture making, some sort of like factory down there.
How is Raymond dealing with this attention? He must know what's going on. He must know that folks don't want him in your house.
Yeah, but here's a guy who'd been in the criminal system here for how many years, and so he's lived in a place of danger and threats. And honestly, this doesn't really faze him too much. He has deep faith. And I don't know if he'd like me to say this, but his greatest fear are the feds.
Really?
Yeah. I think they would be happier if he failed parole and they could lock him up. He'd be a lot easier to take care of. They wouldn't be handling this heat. This is not easy for them, and they're taking a lot of flack. And so, you know, that was his statement up front with me early on, you know, that, you know, neighbors shooting off guns, which in our neighborhood isn't abnormal. We're in a very rural area. My son did target practicing out in our backyard. I mean, so, but there has been coordinated gun firing to kind of let the criminal in the neighborhood know that the neighbors have guns. So, but that doesn't faze them. And people talk about protests across the street. I don't know if you know what a protest in rural New Hampshire is, but it's like four people standing around their pickup truck talking. I mean, it's not that they're not yelling at us. Again, our townspeople have been very respectful, and I don't know the long-term ramifications on all of our relationships. But we have a lot of support in our town, although that's more the quiet side. So Raymond is doing great. He's staying busy. He's, you know, 35 years in the penitentiary system. He is a man of wanting to be on a schedule, and he's made himself one. He gets up, starts our fire in our wood stove. He feeds our chickens. He spends time with Jesus and the Bible. He waits for me to get up to make coffee. I think he made it once and it didn't work, and so he wakes me to make coffee, and he wants to get out working on our garage. And that's what he's doing until he finds a job.
Reverend David Pinkney, pastor of the River of Grace Church in Concord, New Hampshire. Thanks very much for speaking with us, Reverend.
Hey, glad to be here.
Still ahead today, what's up with President Obama and his ever-present teleprompter? Here and now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. While the American military struggles to fight two wars, a debate is raging in Russia over a controversial plan to overhaul its top-heavy military for the first time since World War II. The goal is a more professional, combat-ready force with 200,000 fewer officers. The BBC's Tim Huell had rare access to two elite Russian units that represent this new force, and he prepared this report.
This is the sound of an army that once struck fear into hearts across Europe. On target practice at their base in the northwestern city of Pskov are some of the most battle-ready of all Russia's million-plus active troops, the men of the elite 76th Airborne Division. But they're part of a radical experiment to give the army a new human face. They're not the downtrodden conscripts who've made up the backbone of the Russian army for hundreds of years. They're eager professionals like Lieutenant Alexei Popov.
It is a very good profession because when you are serving, you will become Russian man because it is glorify their country and motherland.
Three times a day, the men of the 76th Airborne march singing into the canteen for meals and march singing out. It's a timeless image. But now the gradual professionalisation of the army is only the background to even more radical and controversial changes the Kremlin is planning. Veteran military analyst Alexander Goltz.
The moment of truth was the war in Georgia, when military leaders as well as political leaders suddenly saw that we have an army of the middle of previous century.
Russia crushed Georgia, of course, but the war revealed its sluggishness and complacency. These new airborne combat vehicles the paras are training on today, BMD-4s, weren't even used in that conflict, according to senior Lieutenant Ruslan Volkov.
In their technical capabilities, these are far superior to the ones that were used in Georgia. The conflict wasn't serious enough to use these machines.
Now the Kremlin's announced a major rearmament program. But reorganizing the army will be a tougher job. Currently, it's one of the most top-heavy in the world. There are 40 officers to every 100 men, compared to less than 20 in the average Western force.
But for every unit like this that's actively training, there are many, many others in the Russian army that exist on paper only. Equipment that's been mothballed, colonels with no soldiers to command. Tens, perhaps hundreds of thousands of officers will be sacked. Units will be axed. That's why this reform is stirring up so much opposition.
The plan is to slash the officer corps by two-thirds, and the implications of that are enormous, because, as Alexander Goltz believes, it would mean abandoning the principle of mass mobilisation that's governed Russian military planning for generations.
Total rejection from idea of mass mobilisation means that Russian leaders do not see NATO as a possible adversary.
The Kremlin's certainly not announcing that in public. not after years when Vladimir Putin's encouraged his fellow citizens to think that the threat from NATO is increasing. Instead, Kremlin insiders, such as former Deputy Defence Minister Andrei Kakushin, say the new military doctrine that Russia's now formulating will give it a larger role in the world.
We have the area of strategic interests. It's a whole post-Soviet space plus some other places. And there, definitely, if it's needed, we will use the forces to protect our strategic interests.
Could the new military doctrine involve the idea of preemptive action?
I would not exclude it myself personally. Like it is in American military doctrine, like it is in the doctrine of some Western countries. Why not to have it in Russia? We are learning, and maybe I look closer to, that's a good suggestion, I look closer at military doctrines of some of our partners.
That's a veiled threat, of course. America now says it wants to hit the reset button in its relations with Russia. But President Obama's not yet spelt out what that means.
The BBC's Tim Huell in Russia. Before we go today, for the first time since World War II, a First Lady breaks ground on a vegetable garden at the White House. It's Here and Now. Millions of young Americans suffer from eating disorders. They starve, binge, and purge. Some even go online to brag about it. Writer Laurie Holtz Anderson explores this world in her new book, Winter Girls. The novel centers around 17-year-old Leah, whose best friend Cassie was her partner in the pursuit of thinness.
We went to the mall, and I made sure we used the same dressing room so she could see my skeleton shine in the fluorescent blue light. We went to the food court, and she ordered cheese fries, chicken nuggets, and a salad. I drank black coffee and licked artificial sweetener from the palm of my hand. She asked me to guard the door while she puked lunch into the dirty mall toilet. We held hands when we walked down the gingerbread path into the forest, blood dripping from our fingers. We danced with witches and kissed monsters. We turned us into winter girls, and when she tried to leave, I pulled her back into the snow because I was afraid to be alone.
In the book, Cassie's struggle ends in death, and Leah continues to spiral downward into the depths of mental illness, despite the best efforts of her family. And mental illness is just one of the serious issues addressed in the young adult novels by Laurie Holtz Anderson, who joins us on the line from Syracuse, New York. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Your book that you read from Winter Girls is about eating disorders. Your very first novel that is now celebrating its 10th year anniversary is Speak, and that's about depression and rape. What do you think it is that draws you to such dark topics like this for young adults?
Not exactly Pollyanna.
No. I definitely wouldn't call it Pollyanna.
No. I'm actually a very happy person in real life. But I was not a happy teenager. I struggled myself with depression. My family went through some very difficult times, starting when I was in eighth grade. And so I really identify and understand teenagers who have things going on in their lives that they can barely articulate, much less make sense of or try to get on top of. And those are the kids who call to me. That's why I write for them.
And what do you think the books do for them?
I got a letter last night from a kid. It came in about 11 o'clock, an email. A boy who had read Twisted, my novel that has a male protagonist, and said, I don't know what it was, but your book made me feel less alone, and it made me feel better that somebody else is going through this.
Right. One thing that strikes me after having read Winter Girls is in the book, you describe these blogs, these online communities where people are encouraging each other in competing, really, in their eating disorders. Now, Speak, which, as we said, was written 10 years ago, then you didn't write about online communities and how they affect teens. Do you think that were you to write Speak now, you'd almost have to include how that online world influences teenager social lives?
Absolutely. This has become a central part of our teenagers' lives.
Would you say that for the most part you're trying to warn kids of some of the dangers of online communities?
Well, you know, I think online communities are like communities everywhere. You know, you go into a strange town as a 16-year-old. Hopefully you have somebody in your life who can tell you what's a safe place to go and what's not a safe place to go. I see the internet as the same way. but there are way too many kids out there whose parents either are too busy or who aren't present in their lives, who aren't there to kind of, you know, say, I don't want you in this neighborhood.
Mm. Let's talk about the parents' role here. In Winter Girls, there's an awful lot of talk about parental expectations and and how that may be influencing the teenagers flirting with the dark side. In Leah's case, in the main character Leah's case, the parental pressure that was put on her to be successful, to be like her mother, who's a very successful cardiologist. Do you think that that's a very common problem, and is it affecting girls to the point of mental illness quite frequently?
I think all parents have expectations for their children. Sometimes I've seen a number of upper middle class, upper class families in which that bar is set pretty darn high. If the message that you're getting is, you know, it's AP classes or nothing, it's apply to Ivy League schools or nothing, that's a lot of stress. Parents, you know, I'm in the parent generation, and I think that my generation is a little clueless about, A, how much unhealthy pressure we're putting on our kids, and B, how damaging it can be, you know, which isn't to say that there aren't families who have high expectations and their kids do okay, but I see plenty of cases where mom and dad, they're so interested in getting the right bumper sticker for the Volvo, they kind of lose sight of who their child is and what's really right for their child.
Hmm. Why did you choose eating disorders to be sort of the theme around which you bring up some of these issues in Winter Girls?
Two things happened. I received a lot of mail starting 3 years ago where I was hearing from more and more girls who were in eating disorders and who were cutting, which my generation didn't seem to do that much, but this generation sure does. And also I have a dear friend who's a doctor who kept on bothering me to say that I needed to write a book about eating disorders that might touch the lives of girls the way that Speak has.
Now, why don't you explain cutting for folks who may not know?
It's when a person, not necessarily children, adults do this too, for a lot of complicated reasons, feel that they will feel emotionally better if they hurt their bodies. The most common way to do that is to cut your skin with a razor blade or a knife. What I've been told by people who practice it is in that moment of cutting, there is relief and there is a release.
How did you do the research for this book? It's very raw emotionally.
I interviewed physicians. I interviewed specialists who have worked in eating disorder clinics. I knew people who had been in eating disorders either as adolescents or as adults. I pulled from my own pretty poor self-image at times of the way my body looks, the way I feel in my skin. And I went online to see what people with eating disorders were sharing in online forums. And so that's all that kind of intellectual research approach to the writing. But really, there's this magic moment when a writer sits down and you start to hear the voice, or I start to hear the voice in my head of this character, because it's not me. Leah's not me. Leah's not anybody I met or interviewed. Leah is almost, she is a fully formed person in this world that's just outside of my reach. And my job for much of the writing of the book was to turn off my intellect and be open to letting her tell her story through me.
You mentioned being able to remember high school, remember what high school was like, and you do speak very well to that meanness of high school. When you're reading the book, you say, "Oh, I remember how horrible it was to ride on the bus." I mean, just those little things, the clicks, and who's in and who's out, and who's kicking someone from behind, throwing ho-hos in their lap, and all of those things. You really have it right in front in your mind when you're writing. How do you think you do that?
People who know me well would probably tell you that I'm emotionally frozen at age 15. And I stopped maturing then, which in most careers is a negative, but I found the job where it works for me.
Well, do you have fond memories of high school? I know you said your family was going through some tough times when you were that age.
I have fond memories of getting out of high school. For a while there, I was visiting a lot of schools. Somebody once did the math and said that especially when Speak had just come out, I think I've spoken to about 500,000 high school students. in the last decade, and I tell every single one of them that people who say that high school is the best time of your life, those people are lying to you. They're lying. It's so much easier to be an adult than it is to be a teenager. Right. I don't care what anybody says.
Right, right. Laurie Holtz Anderson writes young adult fiction. Her latest book is Winter Girls. Laurie, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. This was wonderful. I really appreciate it.
Maybe he should have had a teleprompter last night. That was when President Barack Obama went on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, and he joked about improving his bad bowling, making this cringe-inducing quip.
I bowled a 129.
That's very good. Yeah. Oh, that's very good, Mr. President.
This is like Special Olympics or something.
It hasn't been a good week for the president. The man known for being an effective communicator has stumbled quite a bit with message and messengers on the AIG bonus mess. It's gotten to the point that conservatives are calling Obama the teleprompter-in-chief, referring to his reliance on the teleprompter for essentially all of his public appearances. There's even a blog said to be written by Obama's teleprompter. Today, the teleprompter writes that, wasn't me last night, the president ad-libbed. John Carroll is Here and Now senior media analyst and assistant professor of mass communications at Boston University, and he joins us in the studio. And John, there was an incident this week with the teleprompter. On St. Patrick's Day, the Irish prime minister accidentally read this speech that Obama had just read, and then Obama apparently jokingly read the start of the prime minister's speech. What's behind this reliance on the teleprompter?
I think what he's trying to do is a couple of things. I think the teleprompter works to help him control his message. It injects an element of reliability. One of the problems is, though, first of all, you can seem distant when you're using the teleprompter. And I think that has come up for him in a couple of situations, especially around the AIG bonuses, that he just didn't seem that engaged because he was using the teleprompter.
Right, right. And then, of course, the comments about the Special Olympics. Do you think that and some of the other missteps that he's made recently, are these surprising?
It's not surprising, really, because he's always been a better communicator in prepared remarks than he has been off the cuff. I think he has a tendency to stumble. He seems to be doing a little bit better. He did fairly well in the town meeting that he did in California the other day. He's probably relying on that and basing his decision on that.
Do you think that that's a failure on the part of Obama?
I don't know if it's a failure. I think the problem is that these things are symbols, and the news media sees on these things as symbols. And for someone who basically campaigned on his authenticity, basically campaigned on his lack of sort of typical political packaging, this can be used against him to say, this guy's just a regular politician. Not only that, he's more canned than most politicians. This guy can't deal with things on the fly.
Right. Obviously, there's been a lot of writing about this. Political pundits are saying a lot of different things. Rick Klein of ABC News said it was a lost week as a great communicator doesn't communicate. Peggy Noonan of the Wall Street Journal said Obama is willowy when people yearn for solid. He's everywhere and nowhere, not fully focused.
I think that it's hard because he's trying to do a lot of things, and half of the time he's defending the fact that he's trying to do a lot of things all at the same time. But I think the message discipline that you would like to have out of the administration and that the Bush administration had in spades is something that they haven't mastered yet. So they're out there, a number of people from the administration, especially on the Treasury and financial side, giving out different messages, giving out conflicting messages and sometimes contradictory messages, especially around the AIG situation.
Right. Well, we should explain that a little bit. That was when White House aide David Axelrod said, it's not like people are sitting around their kitchen tables and talking about AIG. And, of course, that was looked at as a bad comment to be made.
Yeah, no, now they're sitting around their kitchen tables talking about David Axelrod.
Right, right. So it hasn't been well handled, really.
Not at all.
John Carroll, senior media analyst for WBUR and assistant professor of communications at Boston University. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Deb.
Well, First Lady Michelle Obama is breaking ground today on the first White House vegetable garden since Eleanor Roosevelt planted the so-called Victory Garden during World War II. The White House grounds crew and kitchen staff will do most of the gardening, but the First Lady says all of the Obamas, including the president, will pitch in. They'll also get help from fifth graders at Bancroft Elementary School in the district. And Faye Thompson is principal at Bancroft. We reached her today before she and the students were heading to the White House. And Principal Thompson, why was your school chosen to help?
On the humorous side, we really don't know. But we do understand that they looked at the number of gardens, but Bancroft has several gardens right here at the school, which the community and the students and staff started some years ago. And we started off with a butterfly garden, and we have a flower garden, and we have a vegetable garden, and we also have a community garden. And we like to think about the children who live in the city and not having the experience of a garden or knowing how things grow, and also talking about nutrition.
So what kind of a role will the students have in the White House Vegetable Garden long term?
We are going back for the planting. I think we're going back for harvesting. I think we're going back to have a meal. I'm hoping that our children will be able to use some of the seeds from the White House here at Bancroft. But long term, I'm thinking this is going to be a great thing for public education. And when we talk about gardening and food and nutrition and environment.
What are they going to be growing in the garden?
There are lots of vegetables, all kinds of vegetables.
I heard broccoli,
yeah,
right? Romaine and lettuce.
Yes, and fruit and whatnot.
A lot of jokes about the arugula that has to be included in the garden, is
yes.
that right?
Yes, everybody's joking about that one. But that's going to be a learning experience for the majority of us.
Why is that?
Because we don't know about it.
So you're part of the whole local food movement in the U.S.?
I don't know about that. I don't know about a movement, but I do know it's something that we need to talk about more often with children and how everything is connected. You ask a young child, well, where do you get lettuce? Where do you get milk? And they'll tell you the Giant or the Safeway or someplace like that.
Right.
And not knowing all of the steps in between. Somebody had to have an idea. Someone had to plant. Somebody had to nurture it. Somebody had to pick it or harvest. And then it had to get here. They're giving me the sign, the bus. I do not want to be late for the White House.
No, you don't. You don't want to be late for the White House. What are you gonna say to the First Lady today? What do you think the kids are going to say? Did they plan anything?
I know what I'm going to say.
What?
We're going to talk again about public education, and we're happy that she had this idea and that she's moving forward on it and that she has a team that is thorough and the plan is long-term. Very exciting times. You know, change is here. And I'm glad to be a part of it.
All right. Well, don't miss that bus.
Thank you very
much.
Okay.
Faye Thompson, principal at Bancroft Elementary School, where the students there are helping the First Family plant and grow the White House Vegetable Garden today. Thanks very much for taking the time to speak with us.
Muchas gracias. Thank you for calling.